Hey there, loyal listeners. As you know, the Top Games podcast is made possible by Hardcore Gaming 101's Patreon supporters, who help keep this show alive by donating as little as $2 each month. If you were to join them in doing that, you would not only help keep the lights on at HG 101 Towers, you'd also get access to our super secret Patreon RSS feed, which is full of ad-free versions of this podcast with exclusive bonus game rankings. Here's a taste of what you've been missing. The game we're talking about is Alone in the Dark, 2008. This isn't the Alone in the Dark I was thinking about.
Once you get into Central Park, it actually becomes a sandbox game.
How accurate is the depiction of Central Park?
Remember a time when a sandbox map the size of Central Park was considered big enough?
It definitely feels big enough in this game, too. Because you have to drive in the car, it becomes a 50-50 chance that you will accidentally propel yourself off a cliff.
One time I remember I was driving in this game and I drove over a curb and basically the entire car's suspension just flew off.
That sounds like Central Park. Go to patreon.com/HG101 and pledge a couple bucks. That's patreon.com/HG101. Act now and be a hero.
For some, this is painfully obvious, but hardcore gaming means it ain't for the novices. The main source to brain train your knowledge, a lane maintained with a course saved in colleges. To HG101, we give the honor, thanks to Kirk Alada, Xerxes, the host of Proper, as well as Satanga, Cal and Bobinata, Booker Hart and others discuss and discover all the 47,000 games, and when they rate them, you can bet it's scientifically locked in position. Speaking of which, no system is obscure, and look, they wrote a book about it, go out and cop yours.
Hello and welcome to HardcoreGaming101.net's Top 47,858 Games of All Time podcast, where we objectively, definitively, and scientifically rank the games that you nominate. My name is Xerxes, and I'm the show's main host and producer, and on this podcast we have three rules. Rule 1, all rankings are final, official, and scientifically accurate. Rule 2, you can nominate one game at a time via 5-star review on iTunes or Stitcher. Those are the ones we try to get to first. You can also go to bit.ly/rankthisplease. and add a game to the slush pile and cross your fingers. We make no guarantees on those. Rule number 3, you can nominate games that have already been nominated, but just don't nominate games you've already ranked. See the master list for yourself. It's at bit.ly/47kgames. That's bit.ly/47kgames.
Dog's power. Hey, dog's power. Hey, dog's power. Hey, dog's power. Gotcha!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to another exciting episode of this podcast that you're listening to right now and don't need advertised. I don't know why I do that, but I do. This game we're talking about for this episode is Dragon Stomper, which was nominated by Beast of Freddy on Apple Podcast Brazil about 3 years ago or something, and I didn't know about it because I didn't realize that I was getting stuff hidden from me from other Apple Podcasts. Regions. So I think Beast of Freddy nominated 2 games, and because we took so long to get to him, I am doing both of them. But that's not how we're normally doing it.
So the apology factor is real with this one.
Yeah, I think it is. I feel really bad because I thought for sure I was getting all the foreign markets or whatever listener
feedbacks. Groups.
Yeah, but I wasn't. And so this one, like, if Beast of Freddy might not even listen to the show anymore, Beast of Freddy might have stopped listening in total disgust and disappointment. But we will also be doing Wizardry, which...
Oh, Clade's going to be happy about that one.
Yeah, well, I mean, Beast of Freddy has a type, I guess. Okay. Dragon Stomper was developed by Starpath, published by Starpath, formerly Arcadia, as their box art tells you for some reason, for the 2600/Starpath Supercade. Who's with me to talk about this game?
That be Starpath Supercharger, actually, and saying that is Bobnator. Hello.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, my bad.
And I am Word on the Wind. I actually have this game on hardware.
So you have the cassette tapes?
Yes. And nice. A player to play them. I have no idea if there's still any of those pieces are still functional, but I have played this game hardware.
I would bet you a decent amount of money that you like play those cassettes and it's probably like somebody taped over it with like White Snake or something. So this game was released sometime after September 8th, 1982 in the United States for this.
I could not get an exact date. I got the date I did because that is a date a prototype was found for this game, so it had been sometime after that.
Yeah.
All I know was 1982, late-ish.
Yeah, sometime in 1982, in the latter part of 1982. It was, yeah, so it as we said, it was released for the StarPath Supercharger. And this was basically like a third-party adapter that you could use to turn your Atari 2600, which at that point would already be like 4 or 5 years old, and basically turn it into a new console, turn it into something more like, a little bit more like, say, an Intellivision.
And for the record, this game, the thing is also compatible with the Atari 800XL, which is what we have, which was basically an Atari answer to the Commodore 64. It's functionally the same thing as far as what it does and how it does it.
Yeah, I mean, the Atari 8-bit computer family is legendary, of course, almost as much so as the 2600, but I digress.
Basically, what this does is it adds about, I want to say, like 4 to 6 kilobytes of memory. And for a 2600 game, that's pretty huge. You can do a lot with that.
Wait, did
there's
we
about, like, about half a dozen games made with this thing in mind, and this is one of them.
Basically, what this thing was is kind of like a long cartridge that you would plug into your Atari, and it would add 6 kilobytes of RAM to the Atari 2600's existing 128 bytes. Not kilobytes, mind you. Bytes. So basically, like, I guess, like, increase the RAM by, like, I don't know. I mean, exponentially, like, by, like 40-some.
So, to get into why this is a big deal, this game is literally...
Well, I'm not done talking about the StarPath Supercharger, Bob.
Oh, well, go ahead, then.
Okay, thank you. Because this is one of the few things... Like, this is a kind of a rare thing that we can talk about this. I mean, we probably will not get nominated in another Supercharger game for some time, so we might as well explain what it did. So, there's nothing I can say that can possibly live like justify that previous sentence, but I'll try. So it basically like allowed for much better looking games than the 2600 could do. This game would be impossible to do on the 2600, not only because it took up more space, but because it relies heavily on-screen text, which you could not do really. Not in any meaningful way, like just you could barely do like numbers at the top of the screen and have it be legible.
In fact, the font for this is actually quite reasonably sized and legible and isn't in like, you know, 16 by 16 block script.
Nope, it is not. So this like thing that you would plug in, not only did it add RAM, it also had like an output or an input rather, I guess, like a headphone jack. Like thing, 3/4-inch jack, and cable. And you'd plug that into a normal, like your regular tape player, which back in 1982, I'm guessing for me would be like a Care Bears themed tape player. I remember having that was like, you know, basically like a little rectangle, with a single speaker on it. And, but all of them would have input output, jacks. So you could, pop a cassette in that and, load up some data. That way, this is probably, I mean, the cassette data storage era didn't last too long, but boy, it was a wild ride. You could load, and the cassette tapes were literally cassette tapes for those who don't remember this, as word, she could attest to this, that mm-hmm. You have it looks like a regular cassette tape, right?
Yeah, just like if you flipped it upside down, it wouldn't look any different from any other 8-track.
Not 8-track, regular cassette tape, I think.
I didn't live long through the 8-track era, so you'll pardon the
8-tracks were chunky.
Okay, fine.
They were big.
All right, yeah, like the regular. All right,
yeah. Like 8-tracks were like about the size of like an Atari 2600 cartridge.
So did you have to like rewind the tape to start the game again if you had to?
No, you'd have to load it up. So you'd play the tape, I believe, and it would load that information up, right? Mm-hmm. And then it would, yeah. Mm-hmm. So if you played the tape and listened to it,
even though it was a game on tape, it was not a game on tape.
It was designed or developed or whatever by a guy named Stephen Landrum, who you may, if you've heard his name, it's because you're a huge fan of Skate or Die. I believe he is the main designer on Skate or Die. And that is kind of his other, that's probably his most famous game that he did.
I actually didn't know that. That's super cool.
Yeah. So, as you were about to say, Bob, you said, I think you were going to say, this is kind of like, or is widely considered to be the first console RPG.
there's only like one other RPG of that year on the 20th Century I could think of, and I don't even know if it came first or not. I'm going to assume not, because this is a pretty late release for the year. That would be Crypts of Chaos, anyone's wondering.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I don't know anything about that. I had heard of this game. But if you want to learn like every last detail about it, you're in luck, because on the fabulous Hardcore Gaming 101 website, our very own Bobinator, perhaps you've heard of him, wrote a whole article about Dragon Stomper.
And, well, I'm sure I'm missing a lot of trivia, but thank you anyway.
There's only so much you can find. Like, there isn't even, like, GameFAQs doesn't even have a FAQ for this game, which was great if you were trying to play it. Lots of fun. But it's surprising because, you know, I mean, for me, like, the first game I played that was in this style was Dragon Warrior, was the original Dragon Quest. And it felt really different at the time. Because I was aware of like Ultima and stuff like that, but the way it streamlined the combat even further and made it palatable on a console was I thought revolutionary. But when you play Dragon Stomper, you realize somebody else came to a lot of the same conclusions much, much earlier.
Yeah, I am like nearly positive that no one worked on Dragon Quest had any influence on this game, and yet they feel really similar somehow in a lot of ways.
To expand on the flow of the game itself to illustrate the point, you begin in the middle of a field, and every single object that you can run into, be it, you know, just like some blades of grass, a tree, or, you know, some kind of pixel art structure, has the possibility of an encounter of some kind with some kind of a creature. And the game loop at that point broadly consists of getting into fights to acquire, you know, gold and inventory and other things. But then it throws like a little bit of a curveball at you. Some items have set effects and other items have set within a list effects. So a potion on one run might restore your health, where on another run it might decrease your dexterity, which is your basically your fighting competence score as opposed to your health score.
Yeah, you have two main stats in this game that I could tell.
Yeah, strength, which is your health, and dexterity, which is your fighting competence. And there are six items that can have these things varied. If, like, going back to NetHack, you know, is like a very key part of playing the game is identifying just what a given kind of item does. And from there, optimizing, okay, this increases my competence, so I want to always use these as soon as possible. These lower my health. I never want to use these ever, so instead I will sell them at the shop later, which is getting ahead, but whatever. And basically just kind of like figuring out what your situation is. So it has a degree, because the map is set, but the effects of these consumables is randomized within a list. You will always have a representative of each of the effects, but which one is which is different from run to run. So it does have some procedural generation elements to it.
I mean, procedural is not, I think that's how gamers would probably understand it best now, but it's just random elements. There's nothing procedural about this. It's like there's no
Well, I would say it's a procedure given that there's set results, as opposed to you might have three things that restore health and, you know, nothing that detects traps, for example.
The one thing that is that the game does not tell you what a thing does when you use it, so you have to check yourself and write it down.
Indeed, or just remember it. But yeah, it always says feels weird.
Yeah, that doesn't help a lot. There's some funny stuff in this game. So yeah, I mean, as just to back up a little bit, I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. It is like you've got like, you know, a character on an overworld type map of sorts. You're really just a dot, or rather like a dash, and you move around the screen. Like, you're the least detailed object on the screen is your character. You know, but it does have, I think it has random encounters. It certainly has menu-based combat, loot drops, and shops and stuff like that. All the trappings of a console RPG.
Indeed, the encounters, you don't even have to be moving for them. You could just be sitting still and then, oh no,
which
beetle.
Makes a lot more sense when you think about it. Like, you're much more likely to have a, you know, like, for example, if you go hiking, like, you're not, your chances of seeing a bear are pretty low if you're always moving, because you'll make noise and the bears will go away. If you just sit around or are kind of like out of shape like me, and you have to like catch your breath now and then, you have a chance because you won't be making as much noise. So I guess it makes sense. You've got menu commands when you get into a fight. They are just directions on the joystick, because although it was using much better, had higher RAM and all that and had a higher resolution, you're still limited to the inputs on the Atari 2600 controller, which is a button and a joystick.
Which admittedly is kind of a clever idea of how to go about it, rather than the button being used to determine what it is you do. Instead, that's just kind of like, all right, this is just like the initialization point, and then the menu, and then the directionals are what actually drives right. the actions and menus.
Yeah, so like you'll have like a command for, basically you'll have a left, something that pushing the stick left does, and something that pushing a stick right does, and then if you press down, it will just go to the next page of the menu. So it still does work pretty much like you'd expect it to, and this is something that would really, again, not be possible on stock 2600 hardware. You couldn't get this much text on the screen and have it be readable. And you certainly, the idea of, you would never be in a situation like this, because it was a system that was built to do like, twitchy arcade style games, like 70s style arcade games. It is never meant for anything like this. So they do a pretty good job with that. Or I guess he did a pretty good job, Mr. Landrum. There's some interesting things. Like, it does have some very real, more pen and paper style, or I say more pen and paper style mechanics than even CRPG, because most computer RPGs in 1982 couldn't do stuff like this, or wouldn't. You can do some interesting things. Like, you can bribe certain enemies with gold rather than fight them, and they won't fight you. You can also hire warriors to kind of fight for you, right? I don't know, like maybe three or four tops or something like that.
That's a different phase of the game, but I'll get to that.
And the whole game, it's a game that could be finished, which, there were previous Atari games that could do that, like Adventure, for example. But it's still like a game that could take, I think like a normal, regular playthrough, like by somebody who wasn't, already super familiar with the game, would probably take maybe like 2 hours or 90 minutes, which is a long time.
There's one thing I want to say. One thing I think all the text really adds is there are other adventure games on the 2600. There's that Indiana Jones game. There's, you could say, E.T., but this game is way less vague and way less abstract than those games, because it actually tells you what's going on to a point, and that's something you don't really see much of at all.
Yeah, it describes it like, a CRPG would. Like, it kind of tells you what's happening. It gives you more information than I'd say even Dragon Quest did. Which is pretty interesting. It's got other stuff. Like you said, you can gain stats, or decrease stats, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mainly like you can, like your strength isn't really a stat. It's more like your hit points, as I understand it.
And each refresher run I did for this, because, it's kind of been 20 years since I last played this damn game. Each run I did, every time, I got across and I used it, it would hurt me.
Yeah, that's
particular. It was especially great when I walked into a church, got a cross, and it brought me to one health. Thanks, God.
Yeah.
I'll pay your 200 gold tithe to not die.
Yeah, this is an interesting thing that the game does, and I can't tell whether this is deliberate or accidental. But like when you can refill your health by going to a church. There are churches on the map screen, and when you go in, you have the option, you can donate gold. And if you do, you've got a slight chance of getting your health restored, although it's not a guarantee. And in fact, it's for, I think in,
yeah, your options, a lot of people just find donate them. Or to pray, which I don't think ever does anything.
Right. I was getting to that.
Donate 15, which might restore one, or donate 200, which will just about cap you out.
Yeah. So if you donate gold, you'll get restored. Your health gets restored, as we're just said. And but you also have the option of just praying, and praying always, I think always, does nothing.
Like, maybe it does something if you're sitting at one health, but I wasn't really ever in that situation and thinking about it.
I feel like the program had a message here he wanted to give out, but I'm not 100% sure.
But it doesn't totally make sense, because it's just basically saying, like, yes, God exists and has magic powers, but God is greedy and you've got to give it gold.
The dick.
Yeah, it's like, so
wow,
it's
wow,
weird.
It is really an RPG, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, so it's like, you know, which, again, when you think about it, it's kind of, it's funny, but I think that the point of it, I don't think there's any point to it. I think that Word is right. There was something that we just didn't discover about the game, but if you're really desperate and you have like, maybe it waits, it only works if you have no gold and it's like a mercy kind of mechanic.
Something like that, maybe. Yeah.
It might be, but we don't know. I don't think so. Or maybe that was what it was supposed to be and there's a glitch or something. It just never works. But as best we can all tell is that praying never, ever works. And so it's always like you're howling into the void and to no avail. Yet there is some kind of power in the church that can heal you if you give it enough money. Anyway, there's other weird stuff about the game, like the shops work in kind of a bartering system, although not really. But it is kind of clever.
Yeah,
you tell the store shopkeeper what you think is a fair price and they respond. And yeah.
The phases of the game are the initial adventuring phase, which I mentioned, wherein there is a glowing castle on the far west center of the map. And in there, you have to fight off two maniacs, and then you get a piece of paper. You want this paper because on the far east, there's a bridge. And at the bridge, there's a guard. And the guard says, and the description for the guard says, he wants identification. So basically, you provide like a bogus passport to this guard that you get from a glowing castle filled with insane people to actually enter a town.
They're insane, and, but they make a hell of a fake ID.
Can I also say that is super cool that this game from 1982 has like multiple puzzle solutions?
Yeah, you can also bribe the guard, right?
I think you can bribe the guard, but it's like you really do not want to do that because gold is immensely important for the next
phase.
You
want all your money, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if defeating the guard is possible. I know I tried that once when I was younger, and even though I was, you know, a rip-roaring badass, I still just kind of died in ignominy.
It's kind of like fighting Lord British in an Ultima game.
Kind of, yeah.
You can theoretically kill Lord British, but it's not going to happen.
Yeah, so then begins, like, you know, the town phase of the game where there are three shops, one of which is a utilities store, one of them is an apothecary, and one of them is a wizard's hut. And within these, you basically can actually customize how you're going to approach the final phases of the game. And like, you're going to need rope to climb down holes. You'll want scrolls of vision to detect traps in the dragon's cave. You'll want medicine to cure sickness if you spend too much time or get hit by too many traps in there, because those will siphon out your health. You'll want vitamins because that's the full heal, baby. Oh, yeah. And there's various other spells and other utilitarian items that you'll want to pick up to make your journey more useful. And as Xerxes mentioned earlier, there are three like fighters walking around outside in the town. And sometimes they'll just be interested on, you know, thumping a dragon because, you know, hey, cred. But most of them are a little more mercenary about it and will want gold. And you can either pay them an amount of gold, which is going to be very high, or you can stop into the general store, buy a precious gem for like about half what they're asking and give them that instead. Right. And getting these dudes is very useful because I'll get there.
Yeah, I mean, when you fight the dragon, really they're kind of like damage sponges, right? Like,
yeah. Having all three of them makes things immensely easier. And then there's various, you know, spells, like from like a spell that just directly damages the dragon incredibly, or one that makes the dragon unable to act for several turns, which is probably the most important, the most useful spell. But the most important spell is the unlock spell, for reasons I'll get into. Once you actually go into the caves, you actually walk screen-wise upwards through the cave. And there will be like bones on the ground, which means there's traps nearby. So that's when you want to use your vision scroll so you don't step on them. There'll be like these big arrows that will shift from side to side throughout this big cavernous canal that if, you know, they contact with you, it's like, oh yeah, these are poison darts and you got hit with them. And now you're like going to have sickness and whatever. And that'll just siphon out your health. And it actually can get kind of tense.
And I guess you can consider this a dungeon. So there is a first for that too.
Indeed. eventually, like, you'll reach a hole and you need a rope to climb down. I think you get hurt if you don't have the rope and you try and go down. I think chains will also work because those are also available. And down there is more likely than not, you know, Big D itself. And this is the point where you want to deploy the warriors because they will body block the dragon from coming over and will swat at them instead of you. And they can take a beating better than you can. And that's why the stun spell is really good, because if the dragon's not pummeling them, then they're not getting hurt. They're pummeling the dragon, you're pummeling the dragon, and you're actually able to actually, you know, approach it from a reasonably intelligent perspective. There's other spells and whatnot. I think the flash spell might blind the dragon and make it less likely to hit. I'm not entirely certain. There's actually a lot of options, so I can't really detail each of them going through. But should you succeed at defeating the dragon, if you actually want to properly succeed, you need to have brought the unlock spell, because the dragon was guarding I think it's a ring, a precious ring, and I don't remember the narrative reason for wanting this. It's probably in a manual somewhere up in my garage attic. But claiming this ring is the ultimate goal of the game. So if you don't buy the unlock spell, you're screwed.
Yep. Those dragons and their treasure. They can't use it. They've got nothing to spend it on. They love guarding it.
I think if you kill the dragon, the gate also opens.
I don't think so. I think you have to use the spell to open it.
Well, it could also be a difficulty setting thing, because that was a thing on that console.
I don't think this game has any difficulty settings. If it does, it's not a thing I discovered.
So, yeah, that's pretty much the game. And I think the stuff that were described about the end of the game is where it really departs from its console RPG successors. Because it does become like very much more like a pen and paper campaign. It's even more like that than the average CRPG of the time period, which wouldn't do that to you. Like, they would have like set pieces and stuff, but they wouldn't break the game up into stages like that usually. I can't think of any that do. They usually pick they're more about like, I mean, a lot of those games are just battle systems with some graphics and not much else. This game didn't do that. It's interesting. I mean, for me, my favorite thing about the game is that I think the manual says your hero is the Dragon Stomper, which is like a thing in this universe, which I find funny because it's like, you are the legendary Dragon Stomper, Stomper of Dragons. Stomp on this dragon. You don't stomp on the dragon. You kill it with a weapon.
Dragon stomps you, more than likely.
Yeah, it's like,
indeed. I described like a winning strategy there. Make no mistake, the dragon is baller.
You don't stomp on it. You get stomped by it. Like, there's no dragon stomping. It's like, it's also like, I just love that. I love that title because, you know, like, it was
Dragon Stomper sounds like, you know, like a club that caters to specific interests or something.
Yeah. Or it's just like, moving on from that.
You're welcome.
I don't want to get into that. What I like about it is that it just, like, it's very clearly they were going to call it Dragon Slayer, and it wasn't because of the, you know, Japanese game that they couldn't do it. It is for some other, but there was some rights thing, and they're like, well, what else do we call this game?
Wasn't there a film called Dragon Slayer out at around this time?
Could have been. I mean, for all we know, like, the people who made Dragon's Lair were like, it's too close. You're getting too close to Dragon's Lair. Dragon Slayer, it's almost the same thing. You can't do it. And the Starcade people are like, look, we're going to go out of business in like a year and a half. Like, we don't have time for this. I mean, I just, like, you can't call it Dragon Slayer. You can't call it, I guess, Dragon Killer is too dull. What if we call it Dragon Stomper? You stomp on the dragon.
It's like, Stomper is like such an 80s embedded, you know, notion of violent interaction.
You stomp on the dragon. It sounds like you're just like you're stomping on its toes.
Yeah,
and then you run away.
Like when it comes to like modern vernacular, like the closest thing that I could think of that, you know, you could apply would be like curb stomping, which is not what goes on.
Which is
here.
Not really modern vernacular. That goes back like to the moth, like the heyday of the moth.
Exactly. Right? Like that's just like one that's managed to linger around. There's not really anything that kind of really includes on that. You don't really say like stomp on things much these days. At least
it's like what if they called it like? I mean, how could you get like lesser or like more petty? Like what if it's like dragon pusher, dragon scolder?
I can't pursue this line of discussion because it's just going to make me say more dirty jokes.
Okay. So why don't we pursue the line of ranking and rank the dragon stomper?
Okay. This game never gets talked about that much, and I think it deserves a pretty high spot so people will see it and talk about it.
I'm in strong agreement. Like, this is definitely a very innovative and ambitious title that definitely got overlooked.
Like, it's the first console RPG. The people gotta know.
But it wasn't, like, necessarily an influential game, because we can't really say that any console RPG maker after this was like, you know what we gotta do? We gotta do Dragon Stomper. But for the, you know, for some other, nobody played this game.
Like, on the one hand, like, it's true that this was not, you know, particularly inspiring, because who the hell knew about it? But, like, on the other hand, it has a lot of interesting ideas, and it frankly, like, works on those ideas much better than a lot of, you know, like, its early successors that just kind of, like, only emulate a part of it and not really
not emulate that. What they do is they came to the same, they found the same solutions to the same problems.
Which
in a way kind of diminishes Dragon Stomper's importance, because it's like, well, whoever tried this is going to come to the same results because there's only one way to do it. Now, maybe that's not true, but
I don't think that's true. Can't prove considering that, you know, Dragon Stomper went and did a bunch of other ideas that ultimately work for it. And could work for just about anything else, but nothing else went that far.
I guess he went that far, but I mean, Dragon Stomper.
Like, you could just have the entire game be the first phase, and then just kind of like have, you know, the dragon fight be kind of similar to the first phase, which it sort of is, but it isn't, because like, when you run into any of like the enemies in the early parts of the game, they'll just be like a single unmoving graphic that just kind of glides towards you. And it doesn't matter if they're a ghoul or a demon or a beetle or a bug. They all kind of have around the same degree of threat and interaction and capability. But when you actually like throw down with a dragon, like, no, it's over there. It stomps towards you. Like, it's animated. It makes its way over to you slowly, fighting you, like attacking you multiple times per turn, I might add. And it's like actually a scary damn thing, and it is easily the most threatening thing in the game by a far margin. Like, you know, I hate to make, you know, casual references to Souls games, but it's kind of about as impressive as like the first time you're playing like Demon Souls and you run into the Tower Knight, you just kind of like stare at it and you just go, oh shit. And then you get wrecked.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting about the game is I feel like it does owe a lot to pen and paper RPG kind of adventure gaming of the time, because there is this whole idea of like, okay, so at a certain point, the game is all about like gaining skills, gaining treasure, gaining weapons and stuff like that. And then at another point, you've got to like finish the adventure. So you got to prepare for it. And then there's a preparation stage. And then there's the final area, which is basically all about like, okay, you've got the trap stuff. And that's about like testing the players, or the player in this case, how well do they think this through? Or in this game's situation is like, did they play the game before? Because you won't know what to do unless you've done it before.
Do think like that kind of stuff would be covered in the manual, given, you know, the time of the game?
It might be, but the point is that it's like the game is different in the different stages. And I feel like those do mirror very much like the pen and paper stuff. Whereas I feel like it's funny because, you know, Dragon Warrior is trying to do the same thing, but I don't think it has any real relationship to pen and paper games at all. I think it was, it came to the same conclusions, but it was based on, you know, dungeon crawl type CRPGs and Ultima and stuff like that, and trying to recreate that and streamline it so it worked without a keyboard and all that stuff. And it's funny that there's so much overlap, but I think it's really just serendipity. It's just like, it just kind of, that's how it happened. And yeah, I don't know. Like, I can't. I recommend people who are huge fans of RPGs and crude, like, primordial Stone Age RPGs, video games should check this out just to see it, especially if you've already played Adventure. Adventure is, like, I feel like it's a much more playable game because it's so much more simple, but it's not an RPG. It's like, it's more like Zork than it is like Dungeons and Dragons. It's collect the item and do the thing, you know?
I find this far more playable than Colossal Cave Adventure by virtue of the fact that this doesn't, you know, throw you into mazes where, like, the only indication of where the hell you are is how it's parsing the phrase of, you know, you're in this room, even though it's like, and it just does that, you know, in different ways. And then later on just has straight up, no, this is just a damn cave and we're not going to tell you anything about it.
Yeah.
You're just basically like, in an invisible maze.
Yeah. You move through it and eventually there's a hole, and very much like The Immortal, you go down the hole and fight the dragon, which is how that game ends. Right. So yeah, it's, but I don't know how much I would say, like, you should play, like, there's some games that are like, oh, this is like a genre codifier and you should play it just to see where it all began. But you can't really claim that console RPGs began with this. It may be the first.
Like,
but
I
didn't,
I would qualify this one as a forgotten classic myself.
It is, like, it does have, like, more replay value, and it's, I think it would be more fun to modern gamers now than most Atari 2600 games, if you want to count this as one, even though it really is a supercharger game. But yeah, it has more. But then again, like, I would compare it to, I feel like, you know, the even more primitive games like Star Raiders had a lot more replay value than I feel like this one did. This one, the replay value was keep trying it until you figure it out and get like a good run going, and then you've got it. But once you've done it, it sounds like you've done it.
I suppose, but, you know, by the same token, a lot of successors, once you've done it, you've done it.
I guess, but, like, I do feel like, I don't know, I hesitate to recommend this to players. I think it's more of those things like a curiosity. It's like, oh, yeah, check this out, or watch somebody play it on YouTube or something, and just to see what might have been, or what the maximum that could have been done with the 2600 if it had like a lot more RAM and stuff. Like, it's interesting, it's cool, but for me it's more of a novelty than it is like a real classic.
So where would you put it?
I'm gonna scroll down.
The point where I'm looking at right now is 130, which is which would displace Klonoa, Dora to Phantom Isle, and is right below Demon Souls. I already drew my parallel there, and I did that for a reason.
Yeah, don't agree with that.
I know you don't. You never do.
Well, look, whenever you like propose a ranking, it's always like, I'm on this recording because I really like this game or have some personal connection to it. I think it should go in the top like 150 games.
Well, counterpoint, we do have Haunted House 133, and that is another 2600 game that could be argued to make a genre.
I feel like Haunted House holds up on its own terms better than this game does. Haunted House is still like, it still works as a super prototype survival horror game. I feel like Haunted House like is a lot more fun than this too. And it's simpler, better design, doesn't rely on, but then again, like, again, I don't think this was influential at all. I think it was a weird attempt at something that was eventually done later by chance, or perhaps because there's only one way to do this. But anyway, I got it.
Right, so how about you, Bob? You've heard our arguments.
Well, I haven't given a ranking yet, but let's hear what Bob has to say.
Well, I mean, like I said, I feel like this game needs to be noticed. That's what I'm going for. Wherever it ends up, I don't want to get mixed up in the middle where people would pass over it.
I can agree with that.
I'm still kind of hovering like 130, 150 myself. Oh my
god. Okay. All right.
It's not just me, Xerxes.
Why couldn't we have anybody else on this episode?
I'm fairly certain Tax would put this up too.
I know. You're right.
You're the guy who put combat like, what, number 10?
Combat still. Look, have you played combat with another human being, Bob?
Well, truthfully, no.
Okay. All right then. Okay, so maybe you don't know how fun it is. Okay, this game, you've experienced everything there is to experience about it. It's not as good as combat, and we all know it.
I can't claim to have played combat with someone else. I can claim that, you know, the fact that the game just kind of opens up and lets you kind of approach the situation however you wish, and, like, I outlined, you know, a good strategy for it. There's plenty of ways to doing it, because I forgot about the stun spell. I've beaten this game before when I was a kid, and I'd never used it.
Okay. I would put it in the Radical Dreamers, Todd's Adventures in Slime World, Armored Core territory, which would be in the high 230s. And I feel like that is a good spot for it, in my opinion, because that's where games go where I feel like, you know, good on you. Nice try. Like, you did the best with what you had. You came up with some good solutions to some serious problems, and it didn't quite work out for you, but hey, you know, good on you. And it's like, those are the kind of, and Gepi X is another good example. That's like a game that's like, it's not that great of a shooter. Just like, this isn't that great of a console RPG, but it's got like other stuff going for it.
Dragon Quest.
We haven't ranked Dragon Quest. We haven't ranked the original. I don't think that's like a perfect game either. I wouldn't put that up super high either. Just because I played it first doesn't mean I think it's like the best.
I'm just saying, like, I think that for a lot of its, you know, successors in form, you know, I think that this game is way better than a bunch of them until, you know, several sequels down the line for the successors.
No, still Dragon Warrior, the original, is way better than this.
I don't agree with that at all.
It's a better game. It's way better. For one, your character is not like a 2-pixel-wide dash on the screen. For another, like, there's like so much more imagination and stuff that goes into and it's got music. Dragon Quest has music. It's a later game, but it's just like, it's so much more.
Like, I do want to point out that this game does actually have music of a form. Its musical forms take on, like, basically, like, public domain, like, little ditties. Like, whenever you get gold, it plays, you know, the first bar from You're in the Money.
Great.
I don't know if it's, like, a proper thing, but when you encounter a monster, it goes, dun, 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 which in my head translates to the first bar from Dragnet, but I don't think that's quite correct.
Well, I think it's exactly what they were thinking of.
Actually have music. And when you're in the town, it's just blowing wind because, you know, you're at the point, you're in, you know, the calm of the
storm. So I have another idea. Hear me out here. Dune 2 is 222. Dune 2 could be said to make it made a genre. This could be said to make a genre.
Can we at least put it below Shenmue?
Bob, why are you dropping 100 ranks?
Because I'm influential and I wield power over your brains.
What, because you're old?
Yes.
Whatever.
Power.
You like quicks.
Yes. Pronounce kicks, but go ahead.
Kicks, quicks, whatever. That game blows.
Quicks is chocolate milk, my friend.
So, I mean, does that make sense what I'm saying?
Yes, it does. And that's where it goes, right below Dune, right above Shenmue. We're done. That's all for this episode. Special thanks goes out to our lovely co-hosts and compatriots, our booking agent, Jeff Rude, our theme song MC Norm, check him out at Normally Retro on Twitter, and our technical assistant, video editor, and scriptwriter, Ed Burns. You can support this podcast by making a small monthly donation at patreon.com/HG101. I know I did. By subscribing to the HG101 YouTube channel, and by following at GC9X and at HG_101 on Twitter. You can also hang out with us at our Discord channel. It's at bit.ly/HG Discord, but most importantly, help us spread the love of games by getting on iTunes, subscribing to HG101, and giving us a 5-star review. Do it because you like us and you want us to succeed. Until next time, keep keeping it real.